With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Pubcast. I'm Pippa Chambers from Ad News, and I'm here with the editor, Rosie Baker, and we're having a drink with CEO of Havas Media, Mike Wilson, and creative partner at The Works, Paul Swan.
So, how do you both know each other?
All right, in parentheses, I don't want this to be a Naked nostalgia piece, because that's not interesting to anybody, but we worked together at Naked for many years. So we'd set the business up. Paul was one of the very, very first hires, probably around 2004, 2005. Was a media guy in Europe, if I can say that.
Yeah, you can.
You're not trying to hide that.
No, I still get that thrown back.
And then joined Naked, where nobody was media or creative, everybody was everything, and sort of transitioned and blossomed and became the genius creative leader that he is today.
And so, Mike, what made you suggest Paul as a person you'd want to debate the issues of the day with or just have a catch-up with?
He knew I'd be available.
Two reasons. One is I know I can beat him in any debate on any subject, and it's really important for me to always win. But seriously, you asked me who I rated very, very highly in the world of creatives and creativity in the industry, and I see Paul as very much at the front of that list. Now, I can say that with a degree of qualification because we spent a long time working together as well. So
keep going.
That's pretty good praise. What my plan was just to kind of talk about some of the bigger news things that have happened this week and get just your perspectives on them. They don't have to be lofty, they can be positive, negative. The biggest thing creatively, I think, that came out this week was Coca-Cola restructuring its global marketing. And I was in talking to Lisa Wynn, the sort of APAC marketing director, on Wednesday morning just after it launched. And I think it's a hugely interesting shift in their strategy. There's a lot of creative coming out. It's global. It's a big sort of change in how they approach their marketing. What do you think of the creative work, though?
Strategically, I mean, I wouldn't profess to know in detail what they're looking to achieve. From what I understand, it's, I suppose, a simplification. You're working with a wildly complicated situation with Coke, with the scale that it is, with the number of brands, with the number of issues that are circling that sort of world. So I think purely from a simplification perspective, there's something really kind of smart and quite brave, I suppose. The challenge, obviously, is that you have got these different brands and how do they still have a voice and they still do the jobs that maybe they were created to do. I mean, there was a lot of noise about Life launching a year or so ago and what that was doing and how that was playing a role in repositioning the overall brand, I think, in a more health-conscious kind of world. So I suppose the interesting question will be, how does that still happen under this kind of more singular strategy? Creatively, it's all the same issues with a global approach, which is, I suppose, lacking in sort of local nuance and insight that potentially really connects, which maybe could be challenging in a more social media-focused world where, you know, you're looking for that kind of engagement. Yeah, I mean, Mike, you've got a lot of experience on Coke. You know it inside out as a business. So good to get your take on it.
I think from a strategic point of view, what you say is exactly right. I think there's some things to be very much admired in what they've done. So they've got a new marketing director. He's been very single-minded in the strategic direction. I was very impressed that he launched the campaign very publicly. I think he did a press conference where he literally took the gathered trade media, through his strategy presentation slide by slide.
Right. And they're doing the same thing regionally in Hong Kong next week, and I'm going to it. And it's going to be very interesting to see it presented at a global level.
And I've got nothing but admiration for someone who's prepared to back himself to that extent, and it shows great leadership. When it comes to dissecting and analysing and casting opinions, it's very difficult to evaluate a monumental marketing campaign and all of its machinery on the basis of some advertising. Because advertising and marketing aren't the same thing. And in the world of Coca-Cola, and I haven't worked on it for several years, but what I do know is they are some of the smartest, most sophisticated, brilliantly trained marketers that anybody who works with them will agree to. And they wouldn't have done this without an awful lot of analysis. And you have to remember what everybody's doing now is they're harking back to their first experience of Coca-Cola marketing, which is television ads. And Paul's quite right, because my understanding is they've engaged 4 or 5 different creative agencies from different regions of the world. They are doing work that's going to be pooled globally. And in some ways, you could say that's a reflection of their understanding, in some ways, of the diminishing impact of television advertising, because they've taken that away from lots of the local markets and pooled it for a more efficient use of those resources. And I can guarantee you all the other things that happen around the campaigns, and from what they do on the ground, obviously all the work that the bottlers do at retail, that's what drives the business. And yes, let's not judge the potential success of this on the basis of some TV ads that we've probably all seen on our PCs, and then make calls on it. And I think it's too early on the basis of what we've seen to say what it is that sits behind that sort of infrastructure to allow people to go deeper or to share or to inject themselves into it. And you know, we know that they do that brilliantly, as we've seen from previous campaigns.
I reckon that absolutely. I reckon there's a lot more to come under. This is the surface. I mean, I think there was a period recently when Coke seemed to be doing lots of really interesting things from a sort of creative perspective, the small world machines and the share of Coke and all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure they haven't forgotten the impact those kind of initiatives have and the role that this iconic global brand can play. So, yeah, I'd like to think that what we've seen so far is the kind of wrapping paper, and beneath it is a lot of that kind of smart, insightful kind of thinking that we've seen. And I think internally as well, they've got some quite interesting operations around innovation and things like that, which again, I'm sure are just kind of chomping at the bit to fire up and show how they're going to implement the strategy. I haven't had enough time to think about the line and what the line means, because that's, you know, while that is again wrapping, it's quite important.
It is quite core to what the Coke brand has always stood for, the sort of slogan, because they're replacing open happiness, which they've had since 2009, I think, and I never really quite got open happiness.
In the Coke world, they talk about intrinsics and extrinsics. So intrinsics, what's in the bottle, and it's the, you know, it's the product and the taste and all of those things, and extrinsics are the way they make you feel and what you get out of it. And it's not unknown for big companies to change from one to the other and then back again, almost in a cyclical way. And it's possibly not surprising that a new marketing leader globally is going to come on and take a fresh view. And clearly what they've done is they've gone from an extrinsic point of view around open happiness and sentiment and emotion through to a much more intrinsically based campaign. Although I'd say they're having a bet each way, because taste the feeling,
it's
obviously a bit of both.
Intrinsic and extrinsic.
But there may be a tripwire in that, because lots of people I've spoken to said that they don't quite get what are they trying to say, and that's because they're trying to say two things at once and anchoring it in intrinsics, I think, and reminding people how great the product tastes.
I think it's what they said was their problem, that they had done too much kind of focusing on the personalities of what those brands were, and not enough on saying, well, this is why Coke Zero is different to Diet Coke, and this is why you should be wanting that product.
Exactly. So, and, you know, from a pure brand marketing point of view, I mean, you need to talk to the guys and sort of strategic brand experts, but the notion of Diet Coke, Coke Zero, Coke Life as brands in their own right, they obviously all have a different degree of brand equity based on, you know, the time in market and the activities they've done over the years. So it's very, very early in Coke Life's life stage to say what it really stands for, because a lot of those things are accumulated over time. Whereas something Code Red, the main brand, is obviously everybody knows what it stands for, because we all grew up with it, as did our parents. And I completely understand why they've done what they've done. So I think it's less about evaluating the creative at the moment, and more about saying what we're witnessing, I think, is a statement of strategic intent and a great display of leadership from the CMO.
Yeah. I think that the thing talking about the creative, I think that I think is interesting, is that it's a very broad brush, broad appeal, creative approach for this kind of global strategy. And I think that it will be interesting kind of to see through the sort of the course of the year what different regions, different countries do in terms of innovation and local activations in tapping into that. Because one thing that you do sort of get when you watch these ads is that they're so broad, because they do have to try and appeal to everyone everywhere, and that is notoriously difficult to do, because if everyone's your target market, you can try and stand for everything and nothing at all at the same time. And I think that's a really
if you do the right work and you align in the right place, you can still come up with something that captures hearts and minds, even though it has very, very broad appeal. And Coke have been very successful at doing that in the past, and they have to do that because of the nature of their business and what they're trying to do. But also remember, 2016 is the year of two massive events, and Coke are always very, very active and supportive. It's an Olympics year, and it's European Football Championship year, and they will have built their whole programs very much with a view to being able to activate the new positioning in big, major global events with huge on-ground attendances, television audiences. Yeah, we'd be foolish just to look at the TV ads we've seen on YouTube and said, oh, I don't like the ad, I don't like what Coke's doing.
So talking about another kind of creative ad that's been big this year is the Meat and Livestock Australia Day ad. Every year it's kind of looked forward to, and every year it kind of is hyped up, and it is one of the kind of the best ads that people look at the start of the year. This year was obviously shrouded in controversy, and there was a backlash from the vegan, the vocal vegan minority. I think the ad is now the most complained about ad of all time in Australia. What do you think about the kind of the treatment of it in the press and the backlash, and how it's been dealt with in a kind of regulatory thing? Because for MLA, they don't have a massive budget, so the more press and mentions they get, it's kind of like there's no such thing as bad press. But what do you think about the kind of the outcry about it?
First of all, I actually think it's more than an ad, it's an idea, and it actually reminds me of the types of ideas that came out, 4 or 5 years ago, and this isn't to the detriment of it, I'm being complimentary, when people started to produce big integrated ideas, and BMF and Naked and a few other agencies started to produce ideas that had sort of real substance beyond just an execution. And I feel this has this kind of notion of all these people out there around the world missing out, and I could immediately see lots of brilliant ways they can bring this to life, and they've started to roll it out. So I like it because it's a proper idea. It's a big, rounded, integrated idea, first and foremost. So I think the execution is good, and it's well made, and it conveys that idea that they're trying to deliver. I'm a fan. In terms of the controversy and the backlash and all that piece, I can kind of understand it, and I think the issues they're tapping into are ones that people hold very firmly. I, looking at it multiple times, really can't see that it was overly pointed and warranted the reaction that it did. However, people, have wildly differing opinions on, the buttons that are pressed and how they react to them. So I can kind of empathise with that. I don't think it was something they set out to deliberately upset people over. It feels like in the vein of Aussie humour, and I think that's something that should be protected and prized, and
it's in line with what the brand's always really done in its marketing,
exactly.
Isn't it? It's so in line with the personality that they.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was tested. Most stuff of that scale is, and it probably came up somewhere within that testing. They probably did make a call to go with it, and I applaud that as well. That
tamer next year.
Yeah, exactly. But you can't. Mike and I have spoken about this sort of stuff a lot of the time. You kind of do have to be upsetting a few people to have that edge and that tension and that cut through that makes something exciting, and you have to bring the heat into a situation to make it kind of stand out.
I mean, my view on the the LAM ad is that we spend a lot of time, particularly in media agencies, doing evaluation about impact and effectiveness. And you know, there's lots of studies out there that talk about the diminishing impact of television commercials over time versus you know, previous years. But the reality is, just about everybody I know who works in the industry, regardless of what field they're in, still gets excited and proud of really good, uplifting, quality advertising. And I think this does that. I think it's really fun. It's really engaging. Strategically, it's quite interesting because they had a big challenge, didn't they, post Sam Kekovic? You know, they had to make a big statement. There was a lot of positive equity around the Kekovic campaigns historically. And it was interesting. I was talking to someone the other day, and they watched the new ad, and they just assumed automatically that Lamb on Australia Day was an accepted tradition, like turkey on Christmas Day, to the extent that by watching it, you don't even bring into question, should I have lamb on Australia Day? It was just given, and I think they've woven that, you know, complete truism of lamb equals Australia Day, Australia equals lamb, really, really cleverly. Whereas the Kekovic one was much more, you should have lamb, you know, driving people to purchase, you know, very successful and good advertising too. So I think it's great. Adelaide's really funny. It's got loads of gags in it, you know, lots of jokes, and using the different personalities will appeal to lots of different people. The controversy is interesting. I think, personally, I think, you know, what you said, Rosie, I'm sure they'll be rubbing their hands at the column inches and the digital equivalent that they've generated, because it's just going to drive more people to look at the ads, which will work well in their favour. I think if you show a vegan vulnerably cowering in an ad for a meat product, and then you ask someone from the vegan authority what their point of view is, I think the question's quite loaded, isn't it? But the other point about the controversy is they've understood modern channels, because if they'd reproduced that ad 10 years ago, there wouldn't have been anything like the proliferation of commentary, because all those channels didn't exist. Whether it was confected and contrived to create that, I mean, the fact they've got a vegan in the ad suggests they had thought about it, obviously. I think, again, really smart. Is it an outrage? No, of course it's not. It's great. It's great advertising.
Do you think it's a good example of a brand making a brave and a bold, risky choice? Because we talk a lot about being risk averse and there being a lot of safe choices made, and you talked about, Paul, how, you know, that would have been tested and would have been the decision was made at some point to go, is this going to be a problem? Let's go for it anyway. Does that happen anywhere near enough, or does this show that brands should do it more?
With testing and how quickly testing can be done now, there's probably more of it than ever, I think, taking place. I mean, even if a campaign is sort of pretty imminent, you can still kind of get an online poll together and pull some opinions. To an extent, that's giving lots of people lots of things to think about and lots of things to be kind of wary of. But I still think there's lots of people that are sophisticated and will kind of embrace the fact that you do need some of those, that light and shade within things to create it. I suppose there's a channel thing here as well. I mean, I suppose we increasingly talk about, you know, maybe using social content as an opportunity to play in some of those kind of edgier spaces. You can put things up, there's a lower cost of production, there's a lower media weight behind it, you can get a quick read on whether or not people are freaking out over it, or whether or not they're loving it and sharing it and going nuts for it. So,
cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Really, media should be enabling us to try more things, put them out there, gauge reactions, do it and sort of apologise later, maybe is something that's opened up as an opportunity.
I think the reality is we're a very conservative society. We have a conservative culture, and that's often reflected in marketing work. Having said that, there are opportunities for those people who are, you know, prepared to sort of take risks and try into new territories, and they've got the means of doing that now through different forms of content. They live in different places, so I think if you look hard enough, you can still see some interesting places. But there's certainly people can be a bit risk averse when it comes to the big budget pieces, because there's a lot riding on those, and people don't want to make mistakes. But another point about risk is an inherent component of strategy. The strategy is all about making bets about what's going to, you know, drive greater sales, or, you know, get people to buy more often, or whatever it might be. And you need to take, you know, there needs to be a degree of risk taking in there. And I think if you take that element away, you're taking away one of the fundamental pillars and levers of strategic development. And you need to have that in order to do new things and go into new territories. And that's, you know, that's what happens in art, but doesn't necessarily happen in advertising.
Well, that kind of segues quite well into
the...
Yeah, that was good. I was thinking, how am I going to get into here? But so, talking about zero-based budget marketing, so Unilever made this call this week that they're going to change the way that they look at their allocating their marketing budgets, which is, again, another huge shift for a massive global advertiser, one of the biggest spending advertisers globally and locally. So basically, this means that instead of a brand director starting out the year with a $10 million budget, for instance, and then having that $10 million to spend and allocate throughout the year on whatever projects and campaigns, they basically start the year with a zero budget and have to prove to the board, to the CFO, every single thing they're going to spend their money on, what it's worth and what it's going to pay back. So you're having to prove the worth of your marketing before you get the money. I think this is a really, really interesting thing to do. I think it's a massive thing for Unilever to do, and I think it's quite difficult. Do you think it's a good way for marketing to have to operate, to prove itself?
I think like everything, there's some good aspects to it, and there's some challenges, I think. I think originally this model was cooked up by a private equity business.
Yes, I think
You know, some years ago, and had a limited degree
Kraft,
of success.
And Kraft and Mondelez and Heinz in the US have all done versions
of
this.
Elements, that's right. And I think if you're doing zero-based budgeting around businesses, it makes complete sense because it's about cost management. But my challenge around zero-based budgeting is this notion that it tends to be around cost management, not necessarily about value creation. And part of the job of the marketer or the strategist is to create value and to create opportunities. And you will, if you're on a zero-based budget modelling, I would imagine you have to base just about everything you do on historical data. But in marketing, what you're trying to do is create new markets or sell, you know, be innovative. And that maybe that could be quite difficult. But I'm sure they've got models and systems that take that into account. What I like about it, though, is the way it forces people to think about what's right, rather than just doing what's always been done before. And, you know, in an agency environment, for example, one of the sort of workshop things we do at Havas and versions have done previously is you need to get people to think about, you know, what's the best thing you can do, not assume you've got a television advertising budget and then allocate it and then do something with it. So let's start from zero.
Yeah.
And it forces good ideas, good thinking, and as long as you've got, you know, got the right calibre of people and the right processes to drive that, I think it can be a really good discipline.
It's like when, you know, when you've got a really small budget, you're forced to be more creative,
yes,
because you can't afford the excess if you've just got, you know, thousands to spend.
Absolutely. I think there's a great practice that came out of one of the US agencies years ago, which was starting with the press headline you were going to receive for this campaign, and it forced you to think about how you would generate earned media, so without having to kind of rely on it. You know, the media landscape is changing so rapidly, so basing things on, you know, what you did last year in a market which is wildly different from last year and will be wildly different again, you know, it seems like it makes a lot of sense to kind of reset seismic changes in where audiences can be found and where budgets can be apportioned and that kind of thing. So I'm sure it's challenging internally, and, you know, having to start from the ground up each time will be time intensive, and those people have already got a lot to do and a lot on their plate.
It seems like a good discipline to be in, though, to be thinking, do I need to do this, or am I just doing it because I can?
Yeah, but how it brings me back to the cost versus value question.
Yeah.
It's easy to evaluate all of your costs and see if you could be optimising your cost base. That's not the same thing as saying what do we need to do in order to drive the most value.
So if you had a client, if your client was taking this approach,
yeah.
How does that then affect the way you would work with that client? What would you need to prove to them to demonstrate that actually you need this much budget to achieve what you're briefed to do?
We're in an environment at the moment where we do have an awful lot of data, and all the big holding companies in the world have access to systems and tools and experts and data scientists and programs and software analyses and university departments. And I think part of the challenge of today is making sense of all of that in a way that is easily translatable in our daily conversations with our clients and our people. So I'm not sure we're there yet. Again, I know. And the question you're asking, Rosie, is how do you make sense? And in order to make the right decisions around cost to get the best possible outcome, well, then I think you have to bring that knowledge to bear.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it's a very complex world. But you know, what was the cliche last year? Mad men to math men. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we're not jumping straight out of one creative world into a sort of purely data analytics business. It's about understanding how the two things should be brought together.
Well, especially I guess all the media agencies are kind of, you know, touting their wares with their data expertise and reporting analytics,
yeah.
And everything.
Do you know why there isn't a Nobel Prize for maths?
No, I'd be keen to know.
Do
that.
You know that? Do you know why there isn't?
That did not sound like you meant that. That didn't sound.
I have a feeling he's going to tell us.
All right. Well, I'm glad you asked.
Yeah.
Because then Mr. Nobel, his missus ran off with a mathematician.
Oh, okay.
So when he started all his various prizes for all the different disciplines, chemistry, literature, peace, etc., he refused to give one for maths because his wife had left him for a mathematician.
So all mathematicians are still being punished for one woman's infidelity?
Because you can read you can win the Field Medal for mathematics, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well.
And is it also true that Nobel was a dynamite company? Do you know this?
Yeah. They invented dynamite.
Yeah, they basically invented dynamite,
yes.
And the prize
the
was...
The irony of a peace prize, and they invented dynamite.
But that's the whole point, is to kind of offset the damage and destruction that was caused through...
So it's the very origins of a corporate social responsibility policy,
is
the entire Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, might want to fact check that one. Probably
no,
that
it's
in a part.
You said it. It's on record.
Okay.
It's recorded.
I stand by it.
I didn't know either of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're looking, you know, as an agency group to invest in mathematicians to sit behind all your algorithms and all your desks, you need to look at the Field Medal winners. Don't go looking for Nobel Prize winners.
Okay.
So, Paul, you suggested some of the things you sent over looking at awards. And obviously this week, DDB's global team came out and said that they are planning to enter fewer of the global awards programmes. So spending less money on it and kind of, I guess, focusing on the work, not trying to win awards, which sounds pretty much like what the industry should be doing. And I think there's a lot, you know, over recent years been talked about how many awards programmes there are and, you know, how much value do they all offer, what makes them important, why does an agency want to win them. Obviously, the Ad News Agency of the Year awards are about to happen, the entries are just coming.
They're the only ones that matter.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go. Let's stop
that.
The
why
conversation
you're
about awards
the
are
others.
Over.
No. Are there actually any other awards?
No. That aside, you know, we obviously have a great...
Oscars?
No.
In the Ad News Awards.
Yeah.
The
and then, but it would
in
be
the
Ad News Awards and then quite far down
Oscars. Yeah.
They're
the only
behind.
Two.
I mean, maybe we'll give Leonardo DiCaprio an Ad News Award and that will make up for all the Oscars he hasn't won.
Very true.
Perhaps we'll see if he can help.
Yeah. He's a bit of a whiz when it comes to programmatic trading. So
let's do that. But obviously, there's a lot of local award programs, a lot of global ones. There's prestige that comes with winning something like a Cannes Lion or a Clio or a Pencil. But what do you think about DDB's stance in terms of entering fewer and focusing on the ones that matter? What do we think?
It's a good one, isn't it? It's one of those ones that sort of pops its head up every year and probably around this time as we move into that sort of season and everyone starts to question it and debate how many there are and which are the ones that are worth entering and why and all that kind of stuff. And that, the announcement from DDB was probably pretty much there. I know I got a bit of slack for being a bit on the fence because I think it was words like fewer in there. But I think that's probably right, to be honest. I really think there is a really important role for awards within the industry.
Having won a lot yourself last year, the works did quite well.
We had a good run on that, and actually that was kind of interesting for us in that the agency has never really been one to chase those creative awards, and we've sort of put a lot of effort into Effies always, because that's one we've found that clients really, really respond to, and that would be one that would probably be top of the list, I think. And again, the rigour that you need to put into that kind of entry, I think, really sort of proves that there was some grunt behind the campaign, and it did deliver, and yeah, very, very proud of our achievements at that one. But I think any of the awards that really, really push the industry, I think, and I'm a little bit disheartened sometimes when I see new categories being released. I think every now and again there'll be something significant within the industry that warrants that, and means that you need to incorporate it. But sometimes there are these shameless plays that you can sense are more driven by a sort of profit than anything else. I mean, for me, I suppose DNAD will still always be the benchmark, and I think purely defined by how rigorous the criteria are for getting anywhere. And they released a series of videos a year or so ago about the judging process. And I think they were just great for anyone in the industry to watch, because the bar was so high. And to watch the judges debate what for most people would be, you know, their proudest moment in a career, just not making it because of one element letting it down, I think's fantastic. And I think I love that extremity of difficulty, and it's
really being tested what it says it's doing and what it actually does.
Absolutely. And you know, campaigns that scored well all around the world falling down based on kind of one element that wasn't thought through enough, or a little bit of the UX experience, or a bit of crafting or whatever, or I think that's the kind of work we want to do and we aspire to. So I think they're important. I don't think we want an industry without awards. I also think that there is a place for work that is experimental, and I know the work I've been involved in, and I know Mike has too, where we've kind of played along that line. Maybe it's been something experimental that we tried with a pro bono client, or with a smaller brand, and took learnings and then rolled them out for our bigger corporate clients. I think there's a real role for that. Also, just shamelessly from a creative perspective, is the creative people have a desire to make things, and sometimes you can go a while without doing that. And I think to keep your skills sharp and to keep your hand in, to be able to produce things that maybe again for pro bono clients or smaller clients or little side briefs for existing clients is fantastic.
There's no bigger driver for people in work than recognition of some sort. And certainly the ad industry is great at creating various programs which support recognition. And the reality is, you could have a full-time team who did nothing but write award entries from morning till night, every day of the year, given the multitude of local, regional, global, strategic, creative, media, analytic, etc., and the list goes on, awards. So you have to, you have to pick and choose where you think you derive the most benefit. I think what Paul says, certainly about the creative community, has never changed, and there's definitely very highly sought after recognition in the creative community for DNAD, Pencils, and Clio's, and so forth. I think maybe on the other sort of business sides, we tend to look more around where effectiveness is a real key measure. So the Effies always features really highly. And then after that, there's a whole plethora of other awards, which I think agencies will choose to participate in for reasons that they can justify based on their own sort of marketing and growth plans. And there's no doubt that having a good string of awards in any given year or period acts as a fantastic recruitment tool. I mean, to me, it's one of the great things that awards can do for you with recruitment. But having spent an awful lot of time judging awards, sitting in a dark room for days on end, looking at case studies, can we just ban the emotional piano piece that runs underneath the case study. I must have seen 200 of those in a couple of days. And at one point, I just wanted to ban anything I heard with a piano in it. It's just become so cliched.
So what's the best way then to judge work for that recognition? If, you know, case studies and the judging process can be so prolonged and so, you know. What's the best way to do it?
Particularly when you're in a sort of a creative environment, you need to use the same skills that you use when you're producing your work, which is find things that are eye-catching and memorable and cut through.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, you can sit in a room for 10 hours straight with no windows and see a multitude of case studies that all look and sound exactly the same. And for such a creative industry, that's a treasure, that's a missed opportunity.
Yeah. I think it feels like we are at, you know, peak piano.
as far as that sort of stuff is concerned.
I mean, we're actually in the process of putting a few things together for some of the festivals coming up, and desperately trying to think about a different way of doing it. You know, you are restrained a little bit by what's required on the entry forms and the format that...
But nowhere on the entry forms does it make sure you use an emotive, Inaudi-style, emotive piano piece that tugs at the heartstrings for your latest toilet cleaner commercial.
You are right as far as that's concerned. But the format and the structure and all those kind of things, we kind of tend to lead people down a path, don't they? And we end up with these very kind of cookie-cutter case studies. My pet... Peeve is the 48 billion media impressions bit at the end with the press clippings and websites.
The ROI starburst.
Exactly.
That's always a classic.
With the 9 million tweets, Facebook likes, this many inches.
I'd have to confess to being guilty of that as well.
This has been the Ad News Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.